Good evening. Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM. You got local programming here, news, views on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. And right here in the studio, the mystery man has found his way back into the studio again, Mark Levine. Mark, welcome back.
I'm here. These are new studios. I we're not in the old place anymore.
We're not in the golden studios
anymore. Right, right. We're in the beige studios.
Yeah, they're kind of gray and silver. I don't know what's
really,
they're very nice. Silver though. Studios. But at any rate, you're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia. Parts of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, all over creation. At any rate, Mark and I are right here every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. News Views. We have a lot of great guests, a lot of interesting subjects. And as always, we have a great guest and a very interesting subject today. For those of you who have been following the Trayvon Martin case, the prosecutor in the case was involved in another very controversial case, and we have the attorney. Are you here? Kevin, are you online?
I'm online.
All right, we've got we've got our attorney here. Her name is Marissa Alexander.
No, that's not the name of the attorney. That's the name of the defense.
Kevin Cobble. Right. Kevin Cobble is the
let's be clear.
Yeah, that's right. Kevin Cobble is the attorney. But at any rate, Marissa Alexander, and she was charged with a crime in Florida, an African American woman involved in a domestic violence relationship, charged with a crime and attempted to utilize the stand. As I understand it, Kevin's going to fill us in. Attempted to utilize the stand your ground law, which was not she wasn't allowed to use that claim. And ended up getting 20 years.
Why don't you give the basic facts of the case?
Yeah. So, well, here we've got the guy who knows facts of the case.
Right,
so, Mark and I will step aside. We've got Kevin Cobble from Florida. Thank you very much. Tell us a little bit about who you are and, you know, how long you've been practicing law and things of that nature, and then get into the case. So our listeners will kind of get a feeling for who you are.
Like you said, my name is Attorney Kevin Cobble. I practice in Jacksonville, Florida. Was in the First Judicial Circuit, which is the same circuit that Angela Corey and her office are the state attorney for. They're the office that's handling the Trayvon Martin cases, as you guys alluded to. I've been practicing criminal defense in Florida now for over 10 years, and I've had the opportunity to try several of these type cases, Marissa Alexander probably being the most recognizable case that we've had at the office. Ms. Alexander was a young lady who married an individual who had a history of domestic abuse against women, did a series of domestic acts, violent domestic acts against her, even a few when she was pregnant with their daughter. And because of some of those attacks and one that took place on the occasion where she tried to run for her life, retrieved a weapon and fired one shot when he attacked her again. We also tried to use the stand your ground defense in that case, unlike Trayvon Martin's case, where they decided not to use the stand your ground defense that many attorneys across the state of Florida have used, some successfully, some unsuccessfully, and now they're proceeding to trial as we did, and they'll attempt to use it in another way, basically a self-defense argument is what they're going to use.
Okay.
Now, because she was found guilty at trial, she got 20 years in Florida, which is a mandatory sentence based upon someone who fires a gun in the state of Florida. 10 years if you display a gun, 20 years if you fire, 25 to life if you injure somebody with that weapon.
And what was the crime of which she was convicted?
Aggravated battery.
So tell us a little bit about on the date in question, because apparently that was where the question marks were at the scene of the crime, the incident itself. Where were the question marks? What was the disagreement, say, between the prosecution and the defense as to what happened and why she should have been found guilty as opposed to innocent?
Well, I still don't believe she should have been found guilty, and I'll argue that, for the rest of my life. But where you had the argument in the stand your ground, or why she should have been or should not have been able to use what we call deadly force, which is a weapon, the gun in this case, because she was attacked inside of her own home, which she had a legal right to be in that home. But the problem is it was against her spouse, who also had a legal right to be in that home. There's some dispute as to whether or not there was an injunction in place, but whether or not they were abiding by the rules of the injunction. Kind of blurred the lines a little bit, but really not the important fact, because the important fact is once he attacked her, she's allowed to defend herself even in her own home against another individual who lives in that same home.
Did he hit her, Kevin?
He attacked her in the bathroom over some pictures on a cell phone that she sent of her young child. He attacked her in the bathroom, threw her against the wall. There was damage to the doors in the bathroom. Clothes were thrown all over the place. And she got away from the bathroom and actually was able to get through the house. This is only a couple of days after giving birth. I was able to get through the house, got to the garage, was unable to get the garage door open, retrieved a weapon for safety because she knew she had to go back inside of the area where he was. And when he met her in the kitchen, he charged at her again, using explicit the B word, said he was going to kill her. And at that time, she closed her eyes and aimed away from him and high and fired one shot to get him away.
Kevin, the prosecution says a couple things. It says that when she got to her car and got the weapon, that she could have gotten away. Was the fact that it was the garage door broken?
Yeah, the garage door would not open. From the account, the only account that we have is Ms. Alexander saying that the garage door did not open. We heard from basically four witnesses that there, Ms. Alexander, Mr. Gray, and his two young boys. Three of them said they did not believe the garage was open. The only one that said that they think the garage worked, was Mr. Gray himself. So
Rico Gray, the husband who attacked her.
Yeah, 3-1 saying that the garage door did not open and nobody used the garage door that day.
Right. Now, at the scene, I understand that was there some kind of a restraining order or something against him at the time or something to that effect?
And that's what I alluded to earlier. There was we call it an injunction for protection against repeat domestic violence in Florida. And basically what that means is you can go to the courts and ask them to keep the individual away from you permanently, like no contact, or you can have what's called no violent contact. And it originally was a no violent contact provision, and Ms. Alexander had thought about removing it, and they had begun living together again, but it was still a no violent contact regardless, because the injunction had never been waived. And so by him being there, any physical violence that he had against her at all would have been in violation of that injunction. And so he would have been committing a crime in itself right then just by doing that, which is more reason that we showed that she had reason to defend herself.
Has Rico Gray admitted that he attacked her before she got the gun, pushed her against the wall, the damage and so forth? Has he conceded that, or was that an issue of dispute in the trial?
Well, he admitted in deposition, said he had beaten not only her, but several other women. That's how he kept them in line. But then he went back at trial and basically recanted all of that. And we also had the Stand Your Ground hearing before that, which was a 2 or 3 day hearing that we had, which is basically a semi-trial. And at that time, he recanted as well.
In the reports of the case, Rico Gray, and I'm not sympathetic to him at all. I mean, he clearly has a history of domestic violence. He's not a very nice guy. But he says that he was willing to basically drop all charges, and that's why he lied in the deposition, until Marissa Alexander came out on parole and attacked him. And there are photos, at least the ones that have been shown in the press, that show him being hit or, you know, damaged to his face and she having none when she came out on parole. Can you tell us what happened in that incident?
There was an incident when she was out. He had asked to see the child. She had to get some paperwork signed because the young daughter was going to lose her health care benefits. And she had some medical conditions, probably because of some of the beatings that Ms. Alexander took when she was pregnant with their daughter. And so he had agreed to that in email form to come over, sign the papers. When she got there, he tried to get her to stay. That created some controversy. And then when she tried to leave, they got into a physical altercation. And to this day, if you let him tell you, he's going to say she jumped on him. But the history of their whole relationship is him jumping on her. She had knots on her head, was actually taken to the hospital by the police because she had injuries. But the police, in this case, like in the other case, because he called the police, which he has a history of calling the police after he started the violence, even inflicting wounds upon himself, what we heard from some of the other victims that he's beaten, they saw him and they took her to jail again.
Also, Kevin, just to throw a little bit in there, because I'm a retired law enforcement officer. I have a background in law enforcement.
And I'm an attorney.
And he's an attorney.
So we're going all over the legal map here.
But at any rate, that's something that I can definitely vouch for, because I do know that it is almost routine that people that in domestic violence cases that the particularly when it's male that the but not always but when that the aggressor often is the one who calls the police and you know claims that they are in fact the victim, and you get there and the victim's there with a broken nose. But the other part I was going to say is this.
Let me say this real quick. I think that should be a lesson to everyone in our audience that if you are attacked in an issue of domestic violence,
be the first
call the police yourself. Even if the aggressor calls the police, you call the police too.
Right.
And that's very important. If you're lying bleeding on the ground, you can't do that. But it's important if you're in a domestic violence dispute, please call the police. If Marissa Alexander, I don't know if she had access to her cell phone, that Kevin Cobb will get to that, but had she called the police rather than gotten a gun out of her car, this could have been resolved.
Kevin, there's a term that you used basically that he recanted his story. And I'll put it another way. It sounds to me as though he flat out lied, that he said one thing and then he just flat out completely reversed it and said something different. And I took that from when you said basically he said one thing and then he kind of recanted that story. So he pretty much admitted, no, I was lying. Was that an issue in court, in the jury, that in dealing with the judge and the jury, that he had already been demonstrated to have lied in depositions or lied in a hearing and that he couldn't be trusted? And how could the jury, you know, trust the word of this guy when it's already been proven that he's lied once?
Well, that came out twice. In the stand your ground hearing, of course, there is no jury. The judge is the jury. There's a lesser standard of proof there. And it was clear to, I believe, everyone in the courtroom, including the judge, that he had lied about, he was lying on the stand because he completely said something different on several occasions in his deposition. And I think the judge took his credibility, you know, with a grain of salt. I don't think she believed him at all. And that's where we kind of had an issue with her ruling. But she ruled based upon whether or not Ms. Alexander could leave or not as her reasoning for why he ruled against her in the stand your ground. At the jury trial, some of the information that he lied about, we could not use based upon certain evidentiary rules that dealt with the other victims and things like that. We couldn't use that information. So, but they still were able to hear that he had said different things about that evening, other times when he stated he never put his hands on her. And we heard several instances throughout the trial where he put his hands on her and beat her, and there were witnesses to it, even his own kids. And that's why, you know, we're still having a hard time figuring out what the jury and how they came with that decision. They may not have believed him at all. It could have come down to the fact that there was a gunshot and there were children inside the home. Like, it could have been as simple as that. We're just not sure because no one's ever talked to the jury. But I can tell you that when that verdict came down, I would say to a man, and I would go out there and say even probably the state attorneys themselves were shocked by the verdict.
Once again, you're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW here in Washington, D.C. We're talking to Kevin Cobble. He is the attorney for Marissa Alexander. She's an African-American woman in Florida who was convicted of firing a weapon in the vicinity of her husband, who had been arrested and was documented a number of times being involved in domestic violence against her person, including when she was pregnant. No one was injured. She got 20 years. Well, how about this, too? I think Mark had a question. I don't want to go to Mark.
We both got lots of questions.
Go, Mark.
So I got two questions, actually. One is, did the judge find in the stand your ground hearing that the garage worked, or was she not persuaded by the testimony that the garage didn't work?
I think that's where it came. The judge wasn't swayed or did not fully believe or understand whether or not the garage worked or not, but found no information that even they even talked about a landlord coming and testifying, but he couldn't even testify as to whether or not it worked or not. So I think the judge's ruling was, instead of whether or not the garage door worked or not, is that she could have run out another exit, which
could she have? On,
there's a back door. I guess it's not in the direct way, and there's the front door where the children are. The problem is her vehicle, her mode of getting out of there and getting back to the hospital where her daughter was in the garage. So.
So your contention is she could not have left the house without confronting her husband again.
Once she got to the, and I argued again, once she got to the garage, once she was not able to leave, whether it's no matter what door she could have or did go out of, I think the state attorney argued she could have jumped out of a window, which I think is an absurd argument.
She had just had a baby 9 days earlier. You know, she's not exactly a wide receiver for the Green Bay Packers at this point.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you saw grown men that could not get through their rules in New Orleans in Katrina.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about asking to do something superhuman in that kind of condition. But the even when she went back, he never left the house going to the garage. But once he walked into the kitchen and he confronted her again, everything starts over again. It's a brand new encounter where he's attacking her, he's an aggressor, where she has no, you're talking about they're 2 or 3 feet apart, she has nowhere to go. There is nowhere to go. And that's the only time she made the aggressive act of firing that weapon. And she never fired it at him. She fired it in an upward direction.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well,
and I was going to say, you know, just to draw the parallel in the Trayvon Martin case, because for those of you who just tuned in and don't know, the prosecutor in this case was, in fact, is going to be the same prosecutor who was handling the Trayvon Martin case. As an example there, George Zimmerman was in an open area, in fact, pursuing Trayvon. Not only could he have run away, he was, in fact, pursuing the person who he actually ended up shooting but apparently they didn't use the stand your ground case. So it'll be interesting to see how she goes about arguing this case as a prosecutor as opposed to the first one.
There is a 911 tape where Rico Gray immediately after the incident claims that she tried to take a shot at him, and I assume that was pretty powerful evidence against your client. Did she ever call 911 that evening?
She did not call 911, but in fact my client, in every attack that he's perpetrated against her, and as many women that are involved in these, and men too, that are involved in these domestic situations, they don't call the police.
Right.
And they should. And that should be a lesson to all our listeners. They absolutely should. But, I mean, I'm not, this doesn't help your client, but I want to just give the lesson out very clearly to everyone listening to our voice, which is a lot of people. If you're involved in the issue of domestic violence, call the police. I just can't make that more clear. Go ahead, sir.
And that's one of the things that we've tried to, in talking about this case, try to make sure that we're informing people of what they should do in these kind of situations, because everything that reasonably makes sense in this case went the opposite way. And there's a million reasons for that. We had a battered women's specialist come in and testify about the mentality and the mindset these individuals go through after being repeatedly beaten by their abuser. The state didn't bring any information to combat that. They didn't bring any expert testimony to say that she didn't have that syndrome or that wasn't the case. And so it's amazing that they say these women go back sometimes 5, 6, 7 times to an abuser.
Right.
And so this is the world that she was living in. She was in fear for her life every single day. And one of the things that he did say in one of those past depositions is that, I like having those women live on HDL. They never know what they're going to get.
Right. You know, as I was saying before, I have a background in domestic violence and actually teaching about it a bit. But one of the things that people don't understand about it is oftentimes battered women will one of two things. Either they won't call the police because they're afraid of the retaliation. This guy may go to whatever, and when he comes back, there's going to be a price to pay. You know, he may. Sometimes they'll tell him, if you call the police, I'll kill you. Who cares then? I'm not going to go to prison. Or number, that's one. Another unfortunate instance is that in sometimes when you have instances of a domestic violence dynamic within a relationship, and there's issues of codependence and things like that, the woman who's abused will actually in some way kind of protect the abuser and won't call the police because she doesn't want him to get in trouble. And people who don't understand the dynamics will kind of poo-poo that and say, well, that's ridiculous.
True.
But they don't, as you were saying, they don't understand that the dynamics of a domestic violence situation don't work like a normal situation.
Even if she calls the police, a lot of times she won't want to testify. She won't want to press charges. I have a friend who's a prosecutor right here in D.C., and when he does domestic violence cases, a lot of times he goes forward even though the victim doesn't – who called the police, you know, and has the 911 tape where he said, you know, very clearly, he's beating me. He has to use the 911 tape because the woman gets on the stand and says, I was just lying there.
Well, here's another thing that's important. Many times this woman just had a baby. Many times what you see with women that men don't understand is the dynamic of financial support. You've got kids and you've got this guy. And I've heard this before from women who are involved in domestic violence cases. And I didn't want to call the police because he would lose his job and then we wouldn't be able to eat, and I wouldn't be able to feed the kids, and I wouldn't be. So there are so many things involved that a person on the outside doesn't understand when they just look at it and say, well, he called the police and she didn't. She may be looking at it saying, you know, the livelihood and the you know, well-being of me and my children are at risk, and may say, well, you know, I'd rather deal with this domestic violence than have my kids starve. So there are other things involved.
Mr. Koppel, is there any risk of harm to the children? Is there any claim by your client that she got the gun to protect her children from harm from her husband?
Not in this instance. There are accounts, and there were testimonies that he has been physically abusive to the children in the past. But on this particular occasion, no, that was not at issue.
Did this come into the testimony, or was it excluded from evidence, his past attacks on her and his attacks on the children? Did the jury hear that?
Yes. They heard about all the past attacks on her, and I believe it did come out to one of the children that he was scared of his dad at times as well, because there had been physical altercations.
Yeah, had there been any allegation by the children they were scared of their mom or only scared of their dad?
Ms. Alexander is their stepmom, and they both testified that they loved her. She was a great stepmom, you know, did everything for them, went above and beyond, treated them like they were her own children. You had one of the individuals who said he was not scared. He knew exactly why she fired that shot, because his dad was attacking her. The other son, who's a younger son, he still lives with his dad, and he was a little more reluctant to say that. He said that he was scared. I believe his testimony weighed in, but it's his own brother. And other people, his own mother testified, and they all believe that he was under the influence of his dad.
The other thing is, you know, he apparently was testifying, or they believed that she was either trying to shoot him or trying to kill him. Here's my question. What kind of weapon was it, and how many rounds did it hold?
It was a regular 9mm automatic weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I think the standard hold 10 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And one shot was fired.
So clearly...
gun was fired off. No chambers were empty. It was one single shot.
So clearly, if she came out there to kill him, she had 10 more rounds. If she wanted to kill him, and fired one into the wall, then if she wanted to kill him, it's very clearly that she could have continued to fire.
I thought the testimony was she only loaded one bullet in the gun to begin with. Isn't that right?
Well, she didn't. She didn't actually load. I mean, she didn't go outside load the weapon.
Oh, okay.
Was already, you know, like most people, if they have a gun in the house, it's going to be loaded in case somebody comes into your home for protection purposes.
Right. And once again, we're talking to Kevin Koppel. For those who may have just tuned in here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Garland Nixon and Mark Levine, every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. here in Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas. He is the attorney for Marissa Alexander, a black woman in Florida who was denied the ability to use the Stand Your Ground case, who was involved in a confrontation with her husband, who had a documented history of domestic violence, fired one round apparently into a wall or ceiling or something to that effect.
Into a wall and ricocheted
right.
to the ceiling.
No one was injured, she was found guilty of aggravated assault and given 20 years.
Mr. Koppel, I think the question on everyone's mind, and I got to ask it, even though I'm sure it's an impossible one for you to answer as a lawyer, there's nothing worse than this question. I know I've had people ask me this question, but I'm going to ask it of you anyway because I'm a talk radio host and I can do that. The question, of course, is there's a jury of 12 men and women. They heard all the facts. They found your client guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I know as an attorney you didn't want that to happen and you fought hard for that not to happen. In hindsight, can you say why you think that happened? And I'm sorry for the hard question. I know it is.
It's fine because it was a non-capital offense. We had only six jurors.
I see.
In the state of Florida, so it was a six-jury panel.
Yeah, six isn't enough.
Like, every time that you go to trial, if you're a trial attorney, you know this. When you go to trial, whether you have great facts or awful facts, there's a chance that everything that you believe is going to happen, something totally opposite happens.
Yeah.
And this is a case where anybody, you walk down the street, you tell them the facts of the case, whether you tell them facts that are more pro-defense or even facts that are pro-state, they all feel... sympathy for Ms. Alexander, her situation. Some may not understand why she kept going back, but at the end of the day, they all hate Mr. Gray, and they understand where she's coming from. And the majority of them say, she did the right thing, or I would have done the same thing, or I definitely would have found her not guilty. Now, the fact that those six did something totally opposite, something I will never understand, But that's when you have a jury trial, that's the chance that you take. And we're going to see that in the Trayvon Martin case. We have no idea what those 12 individuals are going to say at the end of all the testimony. You just never know.
Are you appealing?
Currently, right now, the attorneys are appealing her case based upon some legal rulings that came out in the trial and end up stand your ground. And that process is ongoing as we speak.
How long has she been in so far towards her 20-year sentence?
I believe we're going on close to 3 years now.
Wow. And in Florida, listeners who might not know, but we're going to go to a break in a couple of minutes, explain how the minimum mandatory sentence worked in this case and why it ended up at the number of 20.
Like I said, in Florida, we have what's called a 10-20 life rule. And if they made it during Jeb Bush's time as our governor, trying to be tough on some of the gang violence and some of the gun violence that was going on in the state of Florida. It was intended for repeat violent offenders and people of that nature who were out there being menaces to society. And so they made a rule that if you commit a crime and you use a gun, you get 10 years in prison. And that's 10 years day for day, no benefit of gang time or any kind of credit or anything of that nature. If you fire a weapon during that, it's 20 years. And if you, like I said, if you hit somebody, it's 25 to life. So because she discharged her weapon during the incident and was found guilty of the aggravated assault, the judge had no discretion whether to give her a lesser sentence or to give her the 20. He had to give her the 20 years. If that rule and that law was not in existence or was allowed to be exempted for some people in battered women situations or first-time offenders, as Ms. Alexander was, then the judge could have given her a sentence, you know, as small as time served, or 12 months, or placed her on probation, or anything of that nature. But those are not options that we have in the state of Florida. And that's why, when you have these stand-your-ground type cases, it's so important that the laws are applied the same way across the state, because you're having outcomes that are affecting people's lives, you know, so severely.
Thank you. Once again, just WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C., Garland Nixon and Mark Levine News Views on Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. right after Democracy Now! We're with Kevin Cobble, the attorney for Marissa Alexander. We're going to take some calls. We're going to take a break. The number is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Feel free to call in. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stand by, Kevin. We want you to stay on the line. Once again, we're back. My name is Garland Nixon. I'm here with Mark Levine and attorney Kevin Cobble, the attorney for Marissa Alexander. And on the board, we've got Bill Weatherspoon. He's our engineer. He's answering the phones. He's making everything happen. On the board, he's sliding the sliders, pushing the buttons and turning the knobs. The number, 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. WPFW, Washington, D.C. Mark.
I'd like to throw out a few more issues for discussion. Obviously, they're the facts of this case. Obviously, Marissa Alexander has her story, and Rico Gray has his story. The judge, the jury, everyone's got their story. It's hard to know. I wasn't there. That's certainly an interesting thing. But I don't want to throw out two general points for our callers to think about. One is the question of mandatory minimums. I and Garland, too, are firmly opposed to mandatory minimums. Every case is different, and a judge should have the ability to say this case merits less than 20 years, and I think they would have found so in this case. The second general issue, though, I'm not on Rich Alexander's side, and that's the stand your ground laws. I hate the stand your ground laws, whether applied to George Zimmerman or to Ms. Alexander, because it seems to me that when you're told you can stand your ground with a gun, that encourages people to use guns rather than get away. I understand Kevin Cobble saying she couldn't have gotten away. I understand that was an issue of contention in the trial. But to me, these laws are bad because they encourage people to stay and fight a gun battle when they really need to get away and call the police.
And the fact of the matter, to throw also with the stand your ground, in an instance here where it very well may have been applicable, they didn't even allow it to be used. So the fact of the matter is you've got people who are using it where it probably shouldn't be used, and an instance where a woman who's a victim of domestic violence tries to use it against a person who has attacked her moments before then, it's still not.
If you are involved in violence, get away and call the police. If you can't get away and you have to act in self-defense, you have to act in self-defense. But if you can get away and call the police, just as a general matter, totally apart from this case, please do so.
Okay, Kevin, we got some calls. Is all right with you? We'll take a couple calls.
That's fine.
Start with Tesfa. Tesfa, welcome to WPFW.
Good evening, my friend.
Good evening, Tesfa.
This lady acted very responsibly. One, she only shot one time. Two, he attacked her repeatedly. It's not one attack, but a repeated attack. And the third point is she gave birth a few days before this attack. A woman, after giving birth, has some difference with other women. In Ethiopian tradition, you don't leave a woman alone after giving birth for 40 days because she is in such deep pain, she could do anything. And medical doctors, I want to ask, did medical doctors testify at this hearing? A woman, 9 days after giving birth, acting this responsibly, is such a magnificent lady, and she should be set free. It's wrong to convict her for 20 days. She is such a responsible woman.
Thank you very much, Tesla. I certainly appreciate it. Next, we're going. He didn't have a question, but I thought, Kevin, I thought that was a great comment.
Well, no, he did have a question. The question was whether it came out at trial.
Oh, yeah.
Any medical testimony about how hard it is for women after giving birth to
having birth, you know, you've got post something or other.
Postpartum depression
and things. Yeah.
The expert that testified mainly to the battered woman syndrome. Mm-hmm. It was made clear throughout the trial, and even with the expert had met repeatedly with Ms. Alexander and was actually one of her psychologists, that she just had a baby. So all that was known. We knew what her mental state was at the time of the incident. And again, that was not challenged by the state attorney's office at all. They didn't put an expert on to challenge any of that. So the jury had that in front of them to make their own decision.
We're going to go to items. But next question is this, and I know, you know, we talk about an exercise in futility, knowing who your governor is. Has there been any pleas to the governor for leniency? And I know we don't want to get into your governor and how I feel about him, but I just want to – maybe somebody else will, you know, win and get this guy out of office at some point or whatever. But what about that perspective, pleas for leniency?
There's a process for the appeal. There's a process for any kind of clemency that anyone could ask for, and I am almost certain that all of those avenues will be exhausted when the time is right for them. Right now, I know they're concentrating on the appeal and making sure that everything is moving forward the way it needs to on that end.
Great. All right, let's go to Ida. Ida, and also the number 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. We've got open lines. Feel free to call in. Ida, welcome to WPFW, and thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Nixon, for having me. I just wanted to make a few statements. I've been listening to you guys, and as a woman who's had children, I can say that I feel very saddened by the results of this case. I feel that I don't own a firearm, but I've considered having one just for safety purposes to protect myself from a break-in or anything. I feel like she had, you know, the right to have a gun. She didn't shoot him, which she could have done, just as you stated. So I agree with that. As a woman who's had a baby, I know that postpartum does affect me. It did affect me, and I know it affects many women. I know that right now there's not many. My question is, was the emphasis on the postpartum not, you know, there because there's not many studies? Because I know it's like a chemical imbalance, and not many people know about it or are looking into it. Having, you know, being in an aggressive situation, having that type of postpartum situation happening, it does affect the woman and their way of thinking. You know, women drop glasses, or we're, you know, nervous, or we're worried about our children. I mean, there's a lot of stress that comes with postpartum, I believe, and that I felt like I personally went through. So my question is, was the postpartum not that emphasized because of the lack of the studies?
Kevin? Thank you very much, Ida. Kevin?
No, yeah, like I said, it was mentioned about the fact that she had a child, some of the mental things that she was going through, but the postpartum as itself on a whole was not argued or explained out fully, because technically there hadn't been a lot of meeting with counselors and things like that after the event. Most of this was things that she was testified by.
Did we lose Kevin?
Uh-oh.
We lost him. Well, hopefully he'll call right back in. But, you know, one of the statements that I was going to make, Mark, is this. I can certainly see, you know, where I defending the case, where I may even stay away from that for this reason. If I'm making the point, this woman was acting responsibly.
Yeah, then you don't want to say she was,
you know, might have
she
been.
She was in some hysterics because she just had a baby.
Right, because I'm not, because. It, unless I'm utilizing the argument that she was not mentally competent, she was not can't be held responsible for knowing the difference between right and wrong at that time. I'm starting to blur the line between arguing she acted within her right mind and she did the right thing, and then I'm arguing but she wasn't in her right mind. And I think, you know, you're a lawyer, Mark. Well, tell me, do you think that's kind of?
I agree. I don't know that that would have been the right strategy. To me, the focus on the garage door is really interesting to me, because I read several accounts of this and I didn't read that the garage door was stuck. And to me, that's the vital issue, because the issue is, in a stand your ground or frankly in a self-defense case, is could she have gotten away? When you hear the prosecutor tell their story, and there's two sides to every story, and I encourage anyone who looks this up, this case, to hear both sides, their point is she could have gotten away. And if it is true that she could have gotten away and not gone back in the house with the gun, then I think the prosecution's got a much better case.
And from what Kevin argued, it sounded as though the older child said the door, in
That's
fact,
right.
was jammed and
That's
you
right.
couldn't get out. The younger child. So really, you've got to wash. I think you've got to assume that
you can't prove that door. But then there's the issue of whether he said, could she use the front door or the back door? And I wonder whether, you know, again, to me, that should be the heart of the trial, whether she could have gotten out or not.
Well, Kevin's here to clear this up.
That's where you find the problems with the stand your ground argument, even the self-defense argument in Florida, is that Florida's broken up into, actually, I work in the Fourth Judicial Circuit, which is Duval County, Jacksonville, Florida, Clay County, and Nassau County. And basically, the way it's applied in different courtrooms in the Fourth Judicial Circuit may be totally different than it's applied down in Dade County or Miami.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. That's not fair. Equal justice under the law.
That's what people have argued, is that what is the standard for stand your ground? Is it somebody having to have the ability to get out into a garage? Is that be able to retreat? Is it being able to walk away through your neighborhood and have somebody follow you, and then all of a sudden something changes? We've had cases where individuals have chased people down the street and stabbed them or shot them, and they've gotten the benefit of stand your ground, which could be something that they argue in Trayvon Martin. The
right.
standard is so differently, it's applied so differently across the board that we don't really know what the standard is.
Because and that, of course, is.
Case, it's not, in a trial, it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
In a stand your ground case, it's preponderance of the evidence. So whoever puts on
51%.
That's greater just by a little percent, 1%. Should win, or 2% should win that case and be immune from prosecution. Wholeheartedly that Ms. Alexander did that. She proved her case greater than 51%, and she should have been granted that immunity.
And you might win that question on appeal.
And that's what we're hoping for.
Okay. We've got some people on. We've got some lines, 202-588-0893. I think we still might have a couple open. We've got some lines flashing. Let's go next to Bookman. Bookman, welcome to WPFW.
Yes. Peace, brother.
Peace.
I just want to ask the attorney, how did the black-white dynamic play in that part? And how many on the jury were white and how many were black? And if in fact in racist Florida, a sister can get 20 years like that, man. There's no damn justice in America, man. Racist Florida? Let's keep it real. I haven't heard even one of the co-hosts talk about racism as of yet. And it's really making me angry, man, as much as I've been listening to PFW. I've been listening to PFW over 25 years, and I heard neither one of you speak about racism in racist Florida, man.
Thank you.
Keep it real, brother.
Thank you, Bookman.
Well, Rico Gray's black too, right? I mean,
but the fact of the matter is, I think what he was talking about was the application of the law.
Whether or not they were harsher against her than they would against a white.
Right, and whether or not if the person were white, would they be convicted? Would they be allowed to use the stand your ground law? Things of that nature. Was there any a racial dynamic in the makeup of the jury or anything else other than as we certainly know within the criminal justice system there
in
are.
Florida, for sure.
Yeah, in Florida, of all places, there are no shortage of inequities. But maybe Kevin could address that a little better.
The legal system, when it comes to the jury process, is very unique. There are good parts about it, and there are definitely some bad parts about it. The jury that we have for Ms. Alexander had one black female, two other women, I believe, and then three men. No other African Americans were on the jury. There was some racial mix among the other individuals, but from the pool we had and the way that we have to pick in the state of Florida, that's the jury we came up with. I mean, we used our challenges. We did what we were supposed to do. The state used their challenges the way they were supposed to. We don't believe anything racial or racist came out in any of the picks of people that were denied. Unlike, I know people argue in some other cases, and it happens, it does happen. But in our case, we got the panel, whether it was the best panel or the worst panel, we got the panel as applicable as we had to apply based on the laws that we have in Florida.
So it doesn't sound like you're blaming the jury as racist, but how do you feel about the prosecution in this case? Do you think that they were harsher on Marissa Alexander than they would have been against a white woman?
We took this case. If this had been a white lady that had fired a shot and was abused, if this had been a Hispanic woman, or if it had been a male in an abusive relationship, we would have made the same argument to the state attorney. We went all the way to the top and sat down with Ms. Corey. We laid out the facts. We thought we had a very compelling case. As the way that the community took it, they thought we had a compelling case. And as the nation has taken it, they thought we had a compelling case. We did everything that we could. I think if you take out race out of it completely, you may have some small dynamic changes. But based upon the facts in this case, this is a battered woman who was beaten by an abusive husband for a long period of time with witnesses and documented events. This case, there should have been a different outcome.
Yeah, so, and I think you've got a couple different dynamics that could be discussed. Surely, understandably, maybe, you know, not by you as a professional attorney who is involved in the case, but by other people out here, such as me, a radio talk show host, but a couple different dynamics, such as, number one, only having one African-American female on the jury of six, which was a pretty small jury, number one. Number two.
And for the record, I hate six-person juries. Yeah. As a lawyer, I think a 12-person jury. I like that old tradition of 12, I think six are more likely to come to the wrong decision.
Yeah, you know, six, that's the number for pallbearers. I never like that. But at any rate, and the fact of the matter is, for those of us who have been in court a lot, such as me, I can say it now that I'm retired. It is my opinion, and only my opinion, that if she were blonde-haired and blue-eyed and 23-year-old white female, the case would have been very, very, very different. It is now, this is my opinion and only my opinion, but having been in court so frequently and having viewed the inequities between, you know, a 17-year-old black, you know, kid, black boy, and a 17-year-old white kid who were charged with the same crime, and sit there and watch the kid get the, you know, the black kid get the book thrown at him, you know, there are one thing we don't talk about, the implicit associations in the minds of people. The implicit associations in the minds when a person sees a 17-year-old black boy, there is an implicit association with the movies that, you know, crime, the news, various things like that. And then they see the blonde-haired, blue-eyed white kid, there's implicit associations with, you know, the private school and all these other things. And these implicit associations are what really makes things happen, unfortunately, all too often. We've got Kevin, we got Brandy up next. Brandy, welcome to WPFW.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Brandy.
Hi, do you hear me?
Oh, yes, hear you
loud
fine.
And clear, and thank
go,
you for calling.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. I just wanted to bring light. I mean, I'm listening to everybody's comments, and maybe there is a racism issue, maybe there are other, you know, factors in play, but for me, it just really highlights the lack of awareness and education in this country and in this society when it comes to the dynamics of domestic violence. As a personal survivor, I just, you know, these men are so manipulative. And when I say men, you know, if even if a woman is doing it, the person who's perpetrating the violence It doesn't just happen in sort of pockets or one at a time. It's ongoing. It's a mental agony that the victim is going through. And so most of the time, women don't leave because they don't have the internal resources. It might not even just be finances or the kids. It might just, you just don't have the internal tools to make a way out. And they capitalize on this. And so for me today, when I hear you guys talking about this case, I'm so sad because how many more women...
Did we just lose her? Brandy?
No, she's
be parading around, you know, feeling justified for their behavior because of this case. It's really sad.
It is. Let me say something. In my personal experience, and obviously I'm not going to name names, I know of three separate instances where a woman approached me with a pretty severe allegation of domestic violence that I believed, that I absolutely thought was true. All three women declined to prosecute, and I have to tell you, I encouraged all three of them to act, to prosecute, to call the police, and despite the fact that I really, really pushed them hard, all three declined, and obviously I wasn't going to call for them. Maybe I should have. I don't know. Maybe you think I should have. But so I know just from my personal experience that this happens a lot, that often the victims, I would probably argue the majority of the time, the victims do not take action.
And Brandy, you're making a great point here, and maybe you could explain it a little bit. But for those who didn't understand it, explain what you mean when you say oftentimes the victim doesn't have the internal resources they need to act in the way that may be in their best interest.
I mean, to say, because the person that's perpetrating the violence is really in my experience, that they have so many emotional deficiencies that the victim ends up having to take care of the person emotionally.
Yeah.
So even once they perpetrate, I mean.
Do we still have Brandy? Did we lose her?
I think she must be on us.
Needed to, like, in the end, even when the courts got involved and everything else, I was reluctant to testify against them because it was this, you feel so responsible for their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And they make you feel as though, you know, I never had anything. I never had a family. I never had this. Now I'm going to lose my life. Now I'm going to go to jail. So on top of you having to sort of deal with your own survival, you have to deal with the guilt of potentially, quote-unquote, destroying the life of someone that you love, even though they're hurting you.
It's a very strong point.
Excellent point. Thank you very much, Brandy. Absolutely stellar call there, you know, on domestic violence.
Very important.
Yeah, I think we've lost. I think Kevin dropped off the line.
He's
back. Kevin,
you
back?
I'm back on the line.
Okay,
great. Yeah, we had some callers talking about the issue of domestic violence and how, unfortunately, it certainly appears in this case, the ignorance relate about domestic violence and the dynamics of domestic violence contributes to a woman such as Miss Alexander here not being able to get justice in our system.
Ooh, we lost someone again. Did we lose Kevin?
We
lost him again.
Kevin.
People need to call in not just on cell phones, folks. If you got a landline,
yeah, somehow we're something's happening. But hopefully we'll get back.
We lose people.
Who do we have? We've got someone else.
We have Wayne.
Welcome.
Hello,
to
Wayne.
BFW.
Yes, glad to be on the air. Quick comment. I love the conversation, but I think also we have to look at the fact that the sympathy for women when it comes to domestic violence kind of blurs the line between what's truth and what's a lie. My experience has been that I've seen it with my own eyes where women, you know, understanding that they will be considered the victim when the cops arrive, abuse the situation and often will invoke a man to act out of his character, given the fact that they know they will be likely considered the victim. So,
well, let me say this. I think in any conflict between two human beings, men or women, there's going to be a dispute. They're both going to see it differently, and the two people are going to see it through their own eyes. No question about it. They're manipulative women, they're manipulative men. But in a case of domestic violence, what usually happens is the woman has injuries. And
you're right.
There is one objective way that may be the only objective way, and of course you can hurt someone without injuries, but that's the only thing we have to determine sort of who's telling the truth. So I have sympathy for the idea that people lie and they get their own issues. That's certainly true. I don't have sympathy though for the idea that women sort of
force a man
to act out of violence. Let me tell you something. No matter what someone says to you, no matter how horrible that person is. I don't believe in fighting words. I don't believe there's any words that can goad you to violence. They can goad you to extreme anger, but there's really just no excuse other than violence for committing violence.
And I would say this. I don't believe that, in my opinion, one of the things you'll say I disagree with, I don't believe that a woman or anybody else can cause a person to act out of the out of their character.
Yeah, yeah.
I
if your character isn't violent, you're not going to commit violence.
Their actions are a reflection of their character. There's an old saying, extreme circumstances don't change people. It exposes people.
I agree.
So if someone says, oh, well, she did this and I had to hit her, the fact of the matter is, what she did was exposed his propensity to hit people or to utilize violence when things didn't go his way. You can, I know anyone who's ever been in a relationship has had an instance where the other person infuriated them.
In this case,
I'm leaving.
In this case, the allegation was that the kid was not his. In fact, that was the allegation, and that's what made him so angry. I can understand that making the man pretty angry. But there's no excuse
for violence. And here's the other thing when it comes to the manipulation
part of it.
Other
than self-defense.
It has been my experience, and I got a lot of experience. It has been my experience that the abusive person is exactly as Brandy said. They are highly manipulative. Mark and I were talking about this earlier today, and Mark will probably remember. As soon as I heard that there was some dispute as to what happened, the first thing I said to Mark was, anyone who is involved with domestic, any man who perpetrates domestic violence on a woman, I don't believe a word they say.
If you have a history.
I don't believe a word they say. Even if I may be wrong, they may be true, but I don't believe a word they say because they're so manipulative, they will absolutely lie. They will look you in the face and say, no, that's not a baseball bat sitting beside me when you're looking at a baseball bat sitting beside
me. Which raises an interesting evidentiary question because our law says that you can't bring in at trial someone's prior bad acts. We do that to say that we don't want to say if someone's got a rap sheet a mile long, people just assume they committed the next crime.
Right.
They may well have, but you have to prove each crime individually. That means that domestic abusers often don't get their past abuse in before
unless they're convicted.
Right. Well, that's right. And so the question really is maybe we should change the laws to allow that in.
You're right. Yeah.
Who do we have next? Is this Latakia?
Well, it looks like we're.
Are we out of time?
We're running out of time. We've got somebody on the line. Okay, we'll give him 1 minute. I certainly appreciate him calling in. Welcome to WPFW. Welcome to WPFW. I hope I didn't get your name wrong, but I do want to give you a minute.
Latoria,
I want to give you a minute to say your piece. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for actually taking the call. I just have a question. And physical aspect of her defending herself, I know that the doctors usually give a written notice saying that they cannot drive within 14 days and it's mandatory. And it's against the law for a woman to drive in the 14 days. Also, having a baby is a major operation, whether it's a cesarean or a vaginal, where there's stitches involved. There is no way someone can escape, whether it be a window, area, and whatsoever. Was that actually looked at?
That's a very good point. Thank you very much. We're kind of running out of time here. That is a very good point, and it's a point I made and a point that the attorney, Kevin Cobble, made, and that was it's a fairly absurd position to take that she could have, quote, jumped out of a window or really, you know, the fact of the matter is she might not even been able to run or move very fast. If she couldn't get out the door, getting by him or getting to another door 9 minutes after giving birth, you know, is certainly
though it's true that if she'd flashed the gun rather than shot the gun, it would have been 10 years rather than 20.
Yeah, right. She just flashed a gun, you know. And unfortunately for Trayvon Martin, my prediction, here's Martin, and this is unfortunate. My prediction is I don't think he's going to get convicted and get a day.
I think he will.
Really?
I think George Zimmerman will be convicted.
Well, that's.
I may be wrong. I hope I'm right. We'll find out.
We certainly will. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. Here in Washington, D.C. And that background music, which is one of my favorite songs. Turn it up a little bit. Let me get a little more of that background music. One of my favorite songs. That is a keyboardist, Shaz. I think he's from France. Good stuff. If you ever get a chance to listen to Shaz, trust me, that's good stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah. But every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. You're listening. You can tune in to WPFW 89.3 FM, and you can listen to News View. I don't even know this.
You're talking music.
Yeah,
News Views.
Yeah, music. No, News Views. No.
News Views.
Music Views.
With
okay.
Garland Nixon and Mark Levin.
That's right. And we have great guests. We've got Senator Ben Cardin is going
to
come on.
Looking
soon.
Forward.
I heard
that.
From his office. They've got a lot of things happening, so we're going to have Senator Ben Cardin on to talk about some of the things going on and some of the things, initiatives that he's working on. And we'll always have lots of guests here on News Views. Also, if you're way out there or if you're going to be out of town, all you have to do is go to WPFW.org. We're live streaming. I don't care if you're in the space station or in Antarctica, wherever you may be on another planet. If you can get access to the World Wide Web, WPFW.org, you can hear us.
I'll tell you something else. If you go to MarkLevineTalk.com, I keep an archive of every show I've done on WPFW, News Views, Raucous Caucus. You bet you go to the archive. You miss anything, it's right there, and you can listen live.
And what is that website again?
MarkLevineTalk.com. MarkLevineTalk.com.
And if someone wants to get in touch with you, Mark?
Just follow me on Facebook. There's a Mark Levine fan page, or just be my friend, and I'll friend you back. Say hello to me and let me know what you want.
I am on Twitter at Garland Nixon, which is GARLANDNIXON, just like President Nixon.
Oh, I tweet too at Mark Levine Talk.
Yeah. I'm at Garland Nixon. Garland Nixon is my Facebook name, and GarlandN@gmail.com, the N for Nixon. GarlandN@gmail.com if you want to email me. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you next
week.
And right now, you got really good music coming from Robin Holden and Carol Tyson. So do not. You think this is good stuff. I'm not a music aficionado. They really know their stuff. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the just completed Public Affairs or News Program.